Tour 12, a military mission. Quebec was without a governor. Who should succeed Champlain? And would his successor be found equally zealous for the faith, and friendly to the mission? These doubts, as he himself tells us, agitated the mind of the Father Superior, Le Jeune, but they were happily set at rest, when, in a morning in June, he saw a ship anchoring in the basin below, and, hastening with his brethren to the landing place, was there met by Charles Huault de Montmagny, a knight of Malta, followed by a train of officers and gentlemen. As they all climbed the rock together, Montmagny saw a crucifix planted by the path. He instantly fell on his knees before it, and nobles, soldiers, sailors, and priests imitated his example. The Jesuits sang Te Deum at the church, and the cannon roared from the adjacent fort. Here the new governor was scarcely installed, when a Jesuit came in to ask if he would be godfather to an Indian about to be baptized. "Most gladly," replied the pious Montmagny. He repaired in the instant to the convert's hut, with a company of gaily apparelled gentlemen, and while the inmates stared in amazement at the scarlet and embroidery, he bestowed in the dying savage the name of Joseph, in honor of the spouse of the Virgin and the patron of New France. 3 days after, he was told that a dead proselyte was to be buried, in which, leaving the lines of the new fortification he was tracing, he took in hand a torch. Delisle, his lieutenant, took another, Repentigny and Saint Jean, gentlemen of his suite, with a band of soldiers, followed, two priests bore the corpse, and thus all moved together in procession to the place of burial. The Jesuits were comforted. Champlain himself had not displayed a zeal so edifying. A considerable reinforcement came out with Montmagny, and among the rest several men of birth and substance, with their families and dependents. "It was a sight to thank God for," exclaims Father Le Jeune, "to behold these delicate young ladies and these tender infants issuing from their wooden prison, like day from the shades of night." The father, it will be remembered, had for some years past seen nothing but squaws, with tapuses waved like mummies and strapped to a board. Both Montmagny and Delisle were half-churchmen, for both were knights of Malta. More and more the power spiritual engrossed the colony. As nearly as might be, the sword itself was in priestly hands. The Jesuits were all in all. Authority, absolute and without appeal, was vested in a council composed of the governor, Le Jeune, and the syndic, an official supposed to represent the interests of the inhabitants. There was no tribunal of justice, and the governor pronounced summarily on all complaints. The church adjoined the fort, and before it was planted a stake bearing a placard with a prohibition against blasphemy, drunkenness, or neglect of mass and other religious rites. To the stake was also attached a chain in iron collar, and hard by was a wooden horse, whereon a culprit was now and then mounted by way of example and warning. In a community so absolutely priest-governed, overt offenses were, however, rare, and, except on the annual arrival of the ships from France, when the rock swarmed with godless sailors, Quebec was a model of decorum, and wore, as its chroniclers tell us, an aspect unspeakably edifying. In the year 1640, various new establishments of religion and charity might have been seen at Quebec. There was the beginning of a college and a seminary for Huron children, an embryo Ursuline convent, an incipient hospital, and a new Algonquin mission at a place called Sillery, 4 miles distant. Champlain's fort had been enlarged and partly rebuilt in stone by Montmagny, who had also laid out streets on the site of the future city, though, as yet the streets had no houses. Behind the fort, and very near it, stood the church and a house for the Jesuits. Both were of pine wood, and this year, 1640, both were burned to the ground, to be afterwards rebuilt in stone. Aside from the fur trade of the company, the whole life of the colony was in missions, convents, religious schools, and hospitals. Here on the rock of Quebec were the appendages, useful and otherwise, of an old established civilization. While, as yet there were no inhabitants, and no immediate hope of any, there were institutions for the care of children, the sick, and the decrepit. All these were supported by a charity, in most cases precarious. The Jesuits relied chiefly on the company, who, by the terms of their patent, were obliged to maintain religious worship. Quebec wore an aspect half military, half monastic. At sunrise and sunset, a squad of soldiers in the pay of the company paraded in the fort, and, as in Champlain's time, the bells of the church rang morning, noon, and night. Confessions, masses, and penances were punctiliously observed, and, from the governor to the meanest laborer, the Jesuit watched and guided all. The social atmosphere of New England itself was not more suffocating. By day and by night, at home, at church, or at his daily work, the colonist lived under the eyes of busy and overzealous priests. At times, the denizens of Quebec grew restless. In 1639, deputies were covertly sent to beg relief in France, and to represent the hell in which the consciences of the colony were kept by the union of the temporal and spiritual authority in the same hands. The very amusements of this pious community were acts of religion. Thus, in the fete day of Saint Joseph, the patron of New France, there was a show of fireworks to do him honor. In the 40 volumes of the Jesuit Relations there is but one pictorial illustration, and this represents the pyrotechnic contrivance in question, together with the figure of the governor in the act of touching it off. But, what is more curious, a Catholic writer of the present day, the Abbe Thalen, in an elaborate and learned work, dilates at length in the details of the display, and this, too, with a gravity which evinces his conviction that squibs, rockets, blue lights, and serpents are important instruments for the saving of souls. In May Day of the same year, 1637, Montmagny planted before the church a maypole surmounted by a triple crown, beneath which were three symbolical circles decorated with wreaths, and bearing severally the names Isis, Maria, Isaac. The soldiers drew up before it, and saluted it with a volley of musketry. In the anniversary of the Dauphin's birth there was a dramatic performance, in which an unbeliever, speaking Algonquin for the profit of the Indians present, was hunted into hell by fiends. Religious processions were frequent. In one of them, the governor in a court dress and a baptized Indian in beaver skins were joint supporters of the canopy which covered the host. In another, six Indians led the van, arrayed each in a velvet coat of scarlet and gold sent them by the king. Then came other Indian converts, two and two, then the foundress of the Ursuline convent, with Indian children in French gowns, then all the Indian girls and women, dressed after their own way, then the priests, then the governor, and finally the whole French population, male and female, except the artillerymen at the fort, who saluted with their cannon the cross and banner borne at the head of the procession. When all was over, the governor and the Jesuits rewarded the Indians with a feast. Now let the stranger enter the church of Notre Dame de la Recouvrance, after vespers. It is full, to the very porch, officers in slouched hats and plumes, musketeers, pikemen, mechanics, and laborers. Here is Montmagny himself, Repentigni and platiri, gentlemen of good birth, damsels of nurture all fitted to the Canadian woods, and, mingled with these, the motionless Indians, wrapped to the throat in embroidered moose hides. Lejeune, not in priestly vestments, but in the common black dress of his order, is before the altar, and in either side is a row of small red-skinned children listening with exemplary decorum, while, with a cheerful, smiling face, he teaches them to kneel, clasp their hands, and sign the cross. All the principal members of this zealous community are present, at once amused and edified at the grave deportment, and the prompt, shrill replies of the infant catechumens, while their parents in the crowd grin delight at the gifts of beads and trinkets with which Lejeune rewards his most proficient pupils. The methods of conversion were simple. The principal appeal was to fear. You do good to your friends, said Lejeune to an Algonquin chief, and you burn your enemies. God does the same. And he painted hell to the startled neophyte as a place where, when he was hungry, he would get nothing to eat but frogs and snakes, and, when thirsty, nothing to drink but flames. Pictures were found invaluable. These holy representations, pursues the Father Superior, are half the instruction that can be given to the Indians. I wanted some pictures of hell and souls in perdition, and a few were sent us on paper, but they are too confused. The devils and the men are so mixed up, that one can make out nothing without particular attention. If 3, 4, or 5 devils were painted tormenting a soul with different punishments, one applying fire, another serpents, another tearing him with pincers, and another holding him fast with a chain, this would have a good effect, especially if everything were made distinct, and misery, rage, and desperation appeared plainly in his face. Quote, the preparation of the convert for baptism was often very slight. A dying Algonquin, who, all meager as a skeleton, had thrown himself, with the last effort of expiring ferocity, in an Iroquois prisoner, and torn off his ear with his teeth, was baptized almost immediately. In the case of converts in health there was far more preparation, yet these often apostatized. The various objects of instruction may all be included in one comprehensive word, submission, an abdication of will and judgment in favor of the spiritual director, who was the interpreter and vicegerent of God.